of the American helicopters just withdrawing the ISIS militiamen from certain areas and moving them to other areas. So the whole world knows but remains silent, as is the case with the Palestinian issue, which is completely a just cause, and the whole world is turning the blind eye to that, from Israeli massacres and the situation in Lebanon with the American pressures and so that are starving people here. So all over the world you have right is right and wrong is wrong, and things are right clear, but unfortunately the American administration is sort of terrorizing and bullying all the media and all over the world, and all the politicians all over the world. Some of them subdue to the pressure, others reject this, and consequently would be confronting the American interests and American plans. But unfortunately, most of the world is just subduing to these pressures by the Americans.
Well, the dilemma of the White House is that it sees maintaining a small, what they call a focused mission inside of Iraq and inside of Syria as well, a worthwhile alternative to a complete full withdrawal of their forces. Yet obviously the Iraqi resistance will not stop its fight back. They will always keep targeting the U.S. occupation forces as long as they remain there. And obviously we've seen similar attacks against their bases in Syria as well. How do you think the Iraqi resistance will receive a possible decision by the U.S. to relocate from Baghdad and maybe go forward northwards Kurdistan? How will they deal with that?
Well, I'm sure also the strategists of the, I'm not going only to talk about the Iraqi resistance here, I'm talking about the axis of resistance in the whole region, is reading very clearly the strategic weaknesses that have grown in the as far as the American administration is concerned, in the whole region and in the whole world in general. We are talking about military-wise and economically and in many other domains. So you have to take into account all these things and disregard whatever the Americans are trying to spread in their propaganda and in their media about their aim to help and assist the poor Iraqi people. They are trying to assist us here in Lebanon, I mean, with besieging us and banning us from getting any necessities that we need to live as a people. So the Americans are doing one thing and on the one hand, and quite the opposite on the other, and while all the time claiming to be the force of good in the whole world, which is the utmost contrast of truth and
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator, for joining us to talk about the latest attacks against U.S. occupation forces in Iraq and possibly also in the future in Syria. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the life and the loss of a Palestinian leader in Damascus. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
A fighter. This is how Ahmad Jibril spent his stormy life, witnessing the smallest details of the Palestinian struggle ever since the Zionist gangs of the first settlers uprooted the pillars of his family home in the village of Yazur near Jaffa in 1948 when he was just 10 years old. Since then, Jibril finally chose to cover his face with the dust of Damascus after he had discovered the secrets of geography between Palestine and the Levant interior, and learned the language of the water flowing towards the south with bullets, and longing to return to the basil and lemon gardens in Yazur. Jibril was laid to rest in his beloved Damascus last week after decades of struggle for liberation that seems today closer than ever because of the thoughts and activism of the likes of late Ahmad Jibril. More in the following report.
On a sad day, July 7, 2021, a great Palestinian icon, Ahmad Jibril Abu Jihad, one of the founders of the contemporary Palestinian Revolution and the Palestine Liberation Organization, passed away in Damascus. With his departure, the Palestinian National Movement and the Palestinian people, as well as the Arab and Islamic nation and the free people of the world, lost a stubborn fighter who did not know despair nor submission. The idea of fighting for Palestine persisted over Jibril's purpose in life. Instead of pursuing higher education, he joined the Syrian army and moved to the military college in Cairo to graduate as a combat lieutenant. Jibril quickly used his knowledge in order to build a force of Fidayeen, fighters for Palestine, to revenge the taking of Palestine by illegal settlers and the Zionist occupation army. He contributed to the establishment of the Palestine Liberation Front and then the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Jibril's bias towards geography was a sufficient reason to establish the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command in 1968, and to separate from the Popular Front and before it from the Fatah movement and its leader Yasser Arafat. He instead chose an alliance with the late President Hafez al-Assad in 1970, an alliance that Jibril remained loyal to until he descended on Friday, July 7, under the soil of the cemetery of the martyrs in Yarmouk camp, south of Damascus. Throughout the years of conflict, the general command did not miss the fateful battles. From fighting at home in Palestine to confronting the enemy in Lebanon, Jibril planned, organized, led, and won most of the battles he fought. From the Hotel War against the forces of the Lebanese Front at that time, which was fought in Beirut with the support of the occupation army, to facing the 1982 invasion of Lebanon on most of the battlefronts, from the south to the coastal line to the capital and Hamdoun to the central Biqa, especially in the famous battles of Sultan Yaqub, to the famous mountain war in which the general command and the Syrian artillery were involved with great influence, so the battle against the Lebanese forces militia was decided at the time. As for the icon of Jibril's achievements, it was the gliders operation in 1987, which aimed to reach an occupation camp in the Galilee using gliders launched from Lebanon. This military achievement was one of the reasons for the outbreak of the First Intifada that year, in which Jibril and the general command played a prominent role in fueling it and providing it with moral and material support. Ahmed Jibril excelled in everything. His deep political vision prompted him to root the general command's relations with the various resistance factions and parties that engaged in fighting, especially Hezbollah and the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, where they all carried out several joint operations. Ahmed Jibril did not leave his two sons, Jihad and Khalid, trust funds and palaces. Rather, they inherited a life project that ends with death solely for Palestine.
Now, to discuss the life of this brave man with us from Damascus is Mr. Tahseen Al-Halabi, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Tahseen. Now, late Ahmed Jibril's bias towards geography was a sufficient reason to establish the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the General Command, in 1968. How do you view the contribution of late Jibril to the fight to liberate Palestine?
You know, in the beginning, Comrade Jibril, he vowed all his life for Palestine, for liberating Palestine. And he also vowed the lives of his four children for Palestine, for liberating Palestine. He lost one, Jihad, the oldest one, as a revenge from the Israeli occupation when they targeted him in Beirut on 2002 in Beirut, because they knew that he was the one that sent from the Sea of Beirut to Gaza lot of weapons and lot of explosives and rockets for the revolution, for the resistance of the Palestinian factions in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Jibril's legacy really is very rich, very also deep in the roots of this resistance. From the beginning, he found that there was no way but to go to the military academy on 1957 to Egypt. In the beginning, he went to the he volunteered to the Syrian army, and he made course for to be an officer, and then he requested to go to the Academy of Cairo in order to get more knowledge about guerrilla warfare, not for conventional armies and conventional weapons for armies. He went there in order to get the background of military activities, of military operations, and then he turned by himself to the knowledge of the expertise of the guerrilla warfare. For this reason, he was the one that graduated from the Academy of Egypt in the specialty of mines and engineering military positions and wireless also communications.
Well, Mr. Tahsin, in relation to the current events happening at the moment as we speak in occupied Palestine, how do you think the mental mold of Ahmed Jibril can affect the current wave of revolution against the occupation and also against the police state now cracking down on the Palestinian natives?
Jibril knew his road very well, and he knew the ways of how to confront the occupation forces. Therefore, when the Oslo Accords was signed by PLO leadership and Israel, he was the one that called all the Palestinian masses inside occupied Palestine to protest, to be against such accords, and to try to make any way to go to the road of resistance. From that moment, he started to receive hundreds of Palestinian youth from West Bank and Gaza Strip in Damascus, in the headquarters of the PFLP General Command. And they were trained here for a few weeks or more than 2 months from Hamas and from Jihad Islami. Many young Palestinian individuals, Palestinian fidaiyin, came here to his headquarters in Damascus, in Syria, and were getting all the making how of explosives, of weapons, of rockets, of a lot of things. And so he made certain
embodied the real resistance of the Palestinians.
In front of them.
Mr. Tahsin, Jibril believed that Palestine is an Arab issue, and he rejected all attempts to isolate it from its Arab depth because of his belief that the liberation of Palestine is an Arab task and not only a Palestinian task, because the Zionist danger does not threaten the Palestinian people alone, it threatens all of us and even goes past the Arab world. Where do you see the current Arab position from all the new changes happening inside Palestine right now?
From the beginning, he knew very well that no faction alone or with other factions, with other Palestinian factions, can liberate Palestine by his own capabilities and military equipments and military activities. He knew that the Palestinian factions should be the spear of the Arab armies that will participate in any war against the occupation forces inside Palestine. He wanted that those factions to be the pioneers on the road of guerrilla war against the Israeli occupation, whether inside Palestine or across the borders, from Jordan, from the Golan Heights boundaries, from South Lebanon, from Gaza, from all those boundaries surrounding Palestine. He tried to prepare such activities and giving military trainings for hundreds of Palestinians in order to do that. But not believing at all that the only Palestinian factions can liberate Palestine. He needed the Arab armies around, surrounding Palestine, occupied Palestine, to participate and to share with this victorious war against
Mr. Tahsin al-Halabi. Mr. Tahsin al-Halabi, a political commentator, we celebrate today a man like Mr. Ahmed Jibril, and we celebrate men like you who have a great history in a struggle against the Zionist occupation on the road to the freedom of Palestine. Thank you very much for joining us from Damascus to celebrate with us this fallen hero. Thank you very much for being with us, and please stay tuned next week for more from our Middle East stream.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. Another point is the discussion of fighting corruption within the branch. This has also started in the branch. It is one of the most important endeavors. It is one of the first and foremost tasks of the judiciary. Of course, I would like to add that sometimes the controversy over the existence of corruption in the judiciary becomes so extreme that even honest, clean, and pious judges are insulted. This is not permissible. The vast majority of judges across the country are honorable, motivated, faithful, uncorrupted, and forgiving people. They are living a hard life and are doing heavy work. We should be careful not to be unkind to them. We should not be unkind to those, which should not be unkind to these pious individuals, who are undoubtedly the majority in the judiciary. But after all, the corrupt elements, no matter how small in numbers they are, exert their impact. In other words, if an average person in a public prosecutor's office or in such and such a court of law does a wrong and corrupt move, and if someone else is notified of it, they might spread it here and there, and subsequently the rumor mill will have it that there is corruption in the judiciary branch. There is only one corrupt person, but the judiciary branch will receive bad publicity. Therefore, your organization should seriously confront this issue so that honorable and pious judges are not insulted and disrespected. However, you should confront, in the true sense of the word, those who should be confronted. Well, we receive many popular reports. Every day, one or two briefings of popular reports and the like are given to me, and I study most of them. There are complaints that we often send to the judiciary. Sometimes it is complained that, for example, a certain financial culprit colludes with a person within a court in a certain city, and that they are accomplices. I sometimes receive such reports. Well, it may be true, it may be a lie, but it matters anyway. This is one of those conditions where you should immediately send the investigation team to investigate as soon as you receive reports like these. This is one of those issues which should not be looked at with optimism.
Around the world with reporters. On Wednesday in the Italian capital, humanitarian activists gathered outside the Italian parliament to stage a protest against an anti-migration deal between Rome and Tripoli. The protest, dubbed a blindfold to avoid seeing the truth, was called by a number of NGOs ahead of a crucial parliamentary vote on the renewal of the accord. Protesters were saying the deal has been causing suffering to tens of thousands of refugees since its signing in 2017.
Under the deal, Italy helps Libyan maritime authorities to stop boats at sea and return the illegal migrants to detention centers in Libya. At least 50,000 people, including thousands of children, have been returned to the northern African country so far. However, the condition in Libya is a matter of concern as they face detention and serious abuse, including rape and torture.
I think it's not a problem, unfortunately, only of the Italian government and the country. It's a European problem, and the European policies, basically, Europe endorses the Italian initiative.
During the protest, activists read messages of desperation sent by the refugees trapped in war-ravaged Libya. Some refugees have unsuccessfully attempted to cross the Mediterranean up to 3-4 times.
Facciamo finta di non vedere cosa succede.
We keep turning a blind eye to what is happening in Libya. The decision to renew the deal is a shameful display of how far EU governments are prepared to go to keep refugees and migrants from Europe's shores.
C'è una parte della politica italiana.
Here in Italy, some politicians deal with the migrants as if they were enemies at the gates, creating fear among Italians. The other politicians make sure not to create too much discomfort to their electorate.
Some lawmakers who attended the protest also said that an Italian Navy ship docked in Tripoli has even directly coordinated the intercepting activities carried out on the refugee boats by the Libyan Coast Guard. Later on Wednesday, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio told the House that Italy will no more fund the Libyan Coast Guard to encourage a management of migrant flows that is more respectful of international norms. By Tripoli, Max Civili, Rome.
Bagram Air Base in northern Parwan province was known as the main U.S. military headquarter in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. This is why experts have blamed the U.S. for wasting international aids to Afghanistan by building America's largest military base in the country.
The U.S. has built Bagram military base by wasting international aids that were earmarked for modernization of the Afghan National Army and the country's development. The airbase is now vacated without U.S. achieving its goals.
As this army general says, the U.S. forces informed Afghans of their pullout earlier, but set no exact time for their departure.
Early morning, once we received some rumors that the U.S. army left the Bagram, we increased our intelligence and our reports, and we got that, yes, they left the Bagram, and after that we entered to the base and took the all towers and secure inside of the Bagram as well.
After talking to the ANA commander, we headed to former symbol of U.S. military power in Afghanistan, Bagram Air Base. A parking lot is located at one of the four entrances of the air base. The U.S. forces have left many of these vehicles behind. Afghan forces say U.S. forces have disabled the electronic systems of these military vehicles instead of disabling the war machine of Taliban.
Now, Afghan officials said they are going to fix such military vehicles to use them in fighting against terrorism across Afghanistan.
After crossing the entrance gate, we faced a real American town where U.S. forces have spent long nights and days despite failing to achieve their major stated goal that was uprooting terrorism here. Now, Afghans are in charge of such mission.
Having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups.
It seems that the U.S. forces had access to high technology, emergency protection measures and welfare amenities in different parts of this airfield to reduce the level of harm, particularly the psychological harm that was coming from the Afghan war to U.S. forces. For instance, this gas station had been supplying fuel to hundreds of big generators across the air base. Afghan forces have collected these GEM tools from different GEMs located in Bagram, saying the U.S. forces had access to not only GEMs, but also to cinema and restaurants as well. Despite being equipped with a modern air defense system protecting Bagram air base during U.S. military presence here, emergency exit ways like this one served as a central part of the base. Meanwhile, there have been hundreds of hideouts like this one built by American troops to protect them against possible Taliban rocket attacks. Visiting residential buildings of the U.S. forces in Bagram is also a need. But the bitter fact is that the Afghan forces even do not have access to the codes of some doors of the residential buildings in Bagram.
So they have no way but to use things like this chair to keep the doors open.
And here is a residential room that was used by American soldiers in the Bagram military air base.
The presence of meal packages, air conditioner systems, refrigerators, microwaves, internet access and TVs that have been left in residential areas by the US forces once again proves that how big difference was and is between a foreign military soldier and an Afghan soldier. There are also many warehouses like this food warehouse in Bagram. Bagram Hospital is the other destination for us. The modern hospital is dark now and we need to use either torches or our camera light to see what is inside. The flame of Washington's longest war in Afghanistan hospitalized thousands of US soldiers in rooms like this one. These beds, medicines and medical equipment could save the lives of thousands of wounded US troops. But hundreds of them lost their lives here in Bagram Hospital and never returned back to the US due to severe injuries. And now, with rising insecurity in Afghanistan, only time will tell whether or not the Afghan government can make this strategic air base operational due to shortage of financial resources. Sayed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in Northern Parwan Province.
The Iranian government has expressed anger over the participation of Italian politician Franco Frattini to a hybrid virtual and face-to-face meeting hosted by terror organization MKO in Albania last weekend. MKO is seen by geopolitical experts as a dangerous sectarian group that was on the list of terrorist organizations of the EU and the US for several years. Despite that, a number of international figures, including former US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, have given their full support for this group.
The truth is that the MKO has always been instrumental to the geopolitical strategies of Western countries. It's been designated as a terrorist organization for many years, and its delisting was very much linked to a plan to increase pressure on Tehran. This only shows the double standards of the West when it comes to terrorist groups. MKO's collusion with the US and the Israeli intelligence is a known fact.
Frattini is a former European Commissioner and Foreign Minister under two Berlusconi governments between 2002 and 2011. As the head of Italy's foreign affairs, in 2003 he sent an Italian military and police contingent to Iraq and Afghanistan in support of the US hegemonic influence in the Middle East. Frattini currently holds the post of director of the prestigious Italian Society for International Organization, a non-profit body operating under the supervision of the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Contacted by Press TV, the former Italian minister has declined to comment on its appearance at the MKO event held in Albania.
Frattini's participation in the MKO's annual conference comes as no surprise. Some governments interacting with terrorist organizations to avoid boots-on-the-ground combat operation need well-known political figures who support them to validate their illegal actions.
Iran has summoned the ambassador of Slovenia to Tehran to voice protest at the Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša's participation in the anti-Iran virtual gathering organized by the MKO. In an official letter of protest, Tehran has called the Slovenian Prime Minister's move unacceptable and undiplomatic.
Ties between Italy and Iran have been forever connoted by consistent mutual empathy, to the point that not even the US unilaterally imposed sanctions completely stopped their relations. Rome has long been Tehran's main trade partner, and hundreds of Italian companies are looking forward to fully resuming trade with Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
A Yemeni rights advocacy group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a new report that highlights the destruction of Yemen's infrastructure in over 6 years of war by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies.
The bombardments of civilian areas by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes and artillery units have turned more than 500,000 homes into ruin, The attacks have also targeted 15 airports across Yemen, turning them non-operational. The seaports in the impoverished country, which are the only lifeline for people, have not been spared either. 16 Yemeni ports have been damaged in the coalition airstrikes. The ongoing Saudi-led military campaign has also resulted in the total or partial destruction of 391 hospitals or health facilities.
An important part of the report also highlights the number of victims of the Saudi-led war. The advocacy group says more than 43,000 Yemenis have been either killed or injured in the conflict.
17,176 people have been killed in Saudi-led attacks on Yemen. These include more than 3,800 children and 2,400 women. 26,700 people have also been wounded. These include over 4,200 children and 2,800 women.
Children have sustained a significant number of casualties in Saudi-led attacks. Yet the United Nations last month, in a controversial move, added Yemen's Ansarullah movement to its 2021 list of violators of children's rights. That sparked condemnations with Yemen's political leadership, saying that such a move by the world body is detached from realities on the ground and is not based on independent reports. Last year, the UN removed the Saudi-led coalition from the list of shame, an annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. That despite the UN's own investigators found the coalition of killing or injuring hundreds of children in its relentless bombing campaign on the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia was first included on the blacklist in 2016, but the decision was reversed shortly after the kingdom threatened to cut off funding to UN programs. The UN this year excluded Saudi Arabia from the list not to antagonize the kingdom again. Riyadh, along with some of its allies and backed by the West, has been bombing Yemen since 2015. It has also imposed an all-out blockade on the country. These have resulted in the world's biggest humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where 2 in 3 people, according to the UN, need help to survive, and children are dying from entirely preventable causes in their thousands. According to Yemen's health ministry, at least one child dies every 5 minutes as a result of Saudi siege or attacks. The extent of casualties and damage reveals the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition toward Yemen. Still, the West and the UN continue to show their double standard when it comes to Yemen and embolden Saudi Arabia to continue committing crimes. It seems what matters the most is Saudi petrodollars, not the loss of innocent human lives.
Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, was killed during an attack on his private residence in the capital, Port-au-Prince, last Wednesday. No guard was injured in the attack. Officials have not yet explained how the killers got past Moïse's security detail. They have not said anything about the possible motive behind the assassination either. Haitian police say 28 people were involved in the attack. 3 are Haitian Americans who have been arrested. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military. On Monday, Haitian police said they had caught the mastermind behind the assassination. They said the suspect had used a Florida-based security firm to hire mercenaries to kill the president. Washington has said the evidence provided by the Haitian authorities indicates that the assassination plot was at least partly hatched in the United States. Meanwhile, American television CNN said several of the men involved in Moïse's assassination were previously working as U.S. law enforcement informants. CNN cited people briefed on the matter. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration told it that at least one of the arrested suspects was a confidential source to the administration. Other suspects also had U.S. ties, including working as informants for the FBI. However, the FBI said in response to CNN's reporting that it doesn't comment on informants. A simple history check reveals deep U.S. involvement in Haiti. In 1915, following the assassination of the then-Haitian president, the U.S. sent Marines into the tiny island nation. Washington gained complete control over the Haitian finances and the right to intervene there whenever the U.S. government deemed it necessary. This occupation continued until 1934. With Haiti having a track record of interference from Western governments like the U.S., it remains to be seen whether the country will be able to preserve peace and stability as it goes through this transformation.
disgusting scenes coincided with England's historic defeat against Italy in the Euro 2020 football competition, as fights, vandalism and racism were recorded both before and after full time. The majority of the racism was online and aimed at three black players who failed to score vital penalty kicks, costing England the game. The flood of hate forced even the Prime Minister to speak out against it.
Major clean-up operations taking place just outside Wembley Stadium after the scenes we saw. Many would have hoped that we would have seen an end to hooliganism in the football industry. It was once dubbed the English disease, but it appears after the scenes we saw yesterday that we have some way to go before we can class the English disease as being totally extinct from the industry.
Footage recorded outside the stadium showed mobs of ticketless fans storm past the gates, gaining illegal entry, only to be met by a rival mob of fans fighting to keep them out. While the once clean streets of central London was turned into a giant rubbish tip by frustrated fans lashing out.
The reaction from England fans was both entirely predictable and in keeping with long-standing English traditions of extreme violence and disorder upon defeat. I mean, to support England means to support this sort of behaviour. I think it's an essential part of the supporter culture of the national team. You know, you can't really get more English than spiteful violence to make up for one's own deficiencies. The authorities don't exist to protect minorities, but to punish us. And what I found more disturbing was the number of black and brown people supporting England, you know, out of ignorance, a misplaced sense of identity, self-hatred. This should be a wake-up call for them.
These actions have now led to a Football Association review of England's conduct and condemnation by the London Metropolitan Police. However, if fans can't be properly held in check, England could risk major fines or even be banned from competing in the future. Robert Carter, London.
Yet another attempt by a banned terrorist organization at rebranding itself as a legitimate opposition group in exile. The Mujahideen Khalq organization, known as the MKO, which held its annual gathering in Albania, featuring generously paid politicians and former government officials from the US and Europe, giving carefully worded speeches in person or online. Among them, former British Parliament Speaker John Bercow, the man who recently defected the Conservative Party for Labour after launching a withering attack on his erstwhile party member, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We reached out to Mr. Bercow's media representative requesting for clarification regarding his involvement with the MEK. Received an automated response saying they would be in touch shortly. We are yet to hear from them.
I think our politicians need to be careful about how they behave, and that's politicians of all colour. And I think, unfortunately, they're really stretching the bounds of ethics and what it is to be a public servant, which is very unfortunate.
Former politicians speaking at the MEK's annual gatherings is not without precedent. Over the years, the terror cult has splashed out sizable sums of money to enlist the support of people in power on both sides of the Atlantic. Most notably, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton paid upwards of $40,000 per speech in 2018.
Only three reasons can explain why the former speaker of the British House of Commons might speak to the MKO. Either he literally doesn't know of the thousands and thousands of people this terrorist organization has killed, or he doesn't care about that, or the money was so tempting that it became more important than any moral objections to the MKO.
The MKO, who used to be based in a large military garrison in Iraq, fought against Iran alongside Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and provided material and intelligence support in a conflict that lasted 8 long years and left hundreds of thousands dead, injured, or displaced on either side. In 2000, they were designated as a terrorist organization. 12 years later, the U.S. government removed them from a list of terrorist organizations, and in 2013, the terrorist group relocated to a vast and tightly guarded barracks in Albania that few outsiders have ever entered.
Experts say to see former American and European officials support a known terrorist organization in return for money speaks to the double standard exercised by those individuals when it comes to the issue of terrorism. Syed Purizza, London.
There seems to be no end at sight to tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, China's military announced it drove away a U.S. warship that it said illegally entered Chinese waters near the disputed Paracel Islands. It also urged Washington to stop such provocative actions. In reaction, the U.S. Navy claimed that the USS Benfold asserted navigational rights and freedoms in the vicinity of the Paracel Islands. It also dismissed China's claim of a serious violation of its sovereignty as false and a misrepresentation. The U.S. move coincided with the fifth anniversary of an international arbitral ruling that favored the Philippines and invalidated China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. Beijing has consistently dismissed the tribunal's finding. Regarding the occasion, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on Beijing to stop what he called aggressive acts in the South China Sea. Blinken said that freedom of the seas was an enduring interest of all nations.
Nowhere is the rules-based maritime order under greater threat than in the South China Sea. The People's Republic of China continues to coerce and intimidate Southeast Asian coastal states, threatening freedom of navigation in this critical global thruway.
The South China Sea has become a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past years. The U.S. routinely sends warships and warplanes to the region to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation, ratcheting up tensions among the countries in the region. China has constantly warned the U.S. over its military activities in the contested waters. Beijing and Washington are also at odds over a range of issues, including China's policies with regard to Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as their trade policies and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Amid strained relations between the two sides, there have been fears that the South China Sea could emerge as a potential flashpoint. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under U.S. President Joe Biden, who succeeded Donald Trump in January. But a new administration has shown no sign of backing down on Trump's hardline policies toward China.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know from our explanation so far of Surah Fath, or Manifest Victory, which God Almighty describes the Prophet's Treaty of Hudaybiyah with the pagan Arabs of Mecca, several Bedouin tribes who claimed to be Muslim, but whose hearts were devoid of Islam, disobeyed divine commandments, and resorted to lame excuses, lies, and hypocrisy for their failure to accompany the faithful, since their main concern was booty and not faith, even though the All-Merciful readily forgives those who repent and reform. We continue from where we left you in our last episode a fortnight ago, and here is Ayah 15 of Surah Fatih.
سيقول المخلفون إذا انطلقتم إلى مغانم لتأخذوها ذرونا نتبعكم يريدون أن يبدلوا كلام الله قل لن تتبعونا كذلكم قال الله من قبل فسيقولون بل تحسدوننا بل كانوا لا يفقهون إلا قليلا.
Those who lagged behind at Hudaybiyah will say, when you set out to capture booty of Khaybar, let us follow you. They desire to change the word of Allah. Say, O Prophet, unto them, you shall not follow us. Thus has Allah said in advance. Then they will say, you are envious of us. Rather, they do not understand, but a little. If you might recall, in our last episode of this series a fortnight ago, we explained the preceding ayahs of this surah, saying, wrong assumptions bring ruin and self-destruction, especially when divine laws are deliberately disobeyed. Since our fate depends on our faith and the deeds we do, whether good or bad, which either bring divine rewards or divine punishment. We also said that excessive attachment to worldly possessions hinders people from fulfilling their religious duties. However, the All-Merciful Lord has left the doors of repentance wide open, and His warnings of punishment as well as the tidings of rewards are intended to give hope to the sinners and even to the disbelievers of acceptance of forgiveness through return to the straight and unwavering path. The ayah that we recited to you now was revealed to the campaign of Khaybar against the rebellious Israelite tribes who, along the pagan Arabs, were hatching a plot to attack Medina and kill the Prophet. So, the Prophet, soon after his return to Medina, decided to proceed toward Khaybar and declared that he will take with him only those who had accompanied him to Hudaybiyah, because the Bedouin tribes that did not accompany him on that journey and now wanted to do in their greed for booty were divinely debarred from joining the jihad. Jihad means to strive with sincerity for the sake of Allah and benefit of humanity, whether in war or in peace. In other words, jihad is not for personal gain or booty. These were the facts that the Bedouin Arab tribes failed to understand because of their lack of faith. Although they were clever in worldly matters, they were ignorant of spiritual issues and wrongly said the Muslims and the Prophet were envious of them. This ayah teaches us that, number one, divine mercy precedes divine wrath, and it is only our deeds that bring us reward or punishment. Number two, most Bedouin tribes paid only lip service to Islam, while their hearts were devoid of faith in God and the Prophet. Number three, among the characteristics of hypocrites is that they are opportunistic. They leave the scene at the time of danger by resorting to various pretexts, but when there are easy gains, they want to have the major share in them. And number four, it is the habit of the hypocrites to accuse the faithful in a bid to cover up their own faults and crimes. Now let us listen to Ayah 16 of this surah as the concluding ayah of this week's episode.
قُلْ لِلْمُخَلَّفِينَ مِنَ الْأَعْرَابِ سَتُدْعَوْنَ إِلَىٰ قَوْمٍ أُولِي بَأْسٍ شَدِيدٍ تُقَاتِلُونَهُمْ أَوْ يُسْلِمُونَ فَإِنْ تُطِيعُوا يُؤْتِكُمُ اللَّهُ أَجْرًا حَسَنًا وإن تتولوا كما توليتم من قبل يعذبكم عذابا أليما.
Say to the Bedouins who lagged behind, you will be called against the people of a great might. They will embrace Islam or you will fight them. So if you obey, Allah will give you a good reward. But if you turn away like you turned away before, He will punish you with a painful punishment. This ayah means to tell the Bedouin Arabs who had disobeyed the Prophet's command and failed to accompany believers at Hudaybiyah and then offered their apologies in order to participate in the campaign of Khaybar for a share of spoils, you shall be soon called to fight ferocious opponents who will be called on the embrace the truth of Islam. If you obey divine commandments and fight for Allah's cause, He will grant you fair reward, but if you turn away as you had done before, you will be punished by God Almighty. If you are really regretful of your past, you can prove your honesty in the coming hardship, since God has kept the door of repentance open for you. You should, however, not enter the battlefield with the expectation of booty. In this way, you will receive the mercy that God bestows upon the combatants adhering to the right path. From this ayah, we learn the following points. Number one, the door of repentance is wide open for sinners and disbelievers as part of divine mercy. Number two, we should never underestimate the enemy and never consider past victories as a guarantee for future success. Number three, the Muslims owe to build a formidable power of defense to deter the enemies from any evil designs and to defeat them if they attack. And number four, jihad, whether it is peaceful, striving, or defense against enemies on the battlefield, is for the sake of God and safeguarding of humanitarian values and not any ulterior motives.
half an hour to shower, put on my face, put it all together, top up with a milk tea, and out the door. That's my morning routine. Could take less time. Not for butterfly children, nor for the mother getting her autistic child ready for his care center.